Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A successful entertainment executive making $2 million a year, his former beauty queen wife, their two sons on the fast track to success. But it was all a facade. The killing of Jose and Kitty Menendez on a quiet Sunday evening in Beverly Hills didn't make the cover of People magazine until the arrest of their sons 7 months later, and the case developed an intense cult following. When the first Menendez trial began in July 1993, the public was convinced that Lyle and Eric were a pair of greedy rich kids who had killed loving, devoted parents. But the real story remained buried underneath years of dark secrets until now. Journalist Robert Rann, who originally reported on the case for the Miami Herald and Playboy, has followed the Menendez murders from the beginning and has continued investigating and interviewing key sources for 28 years. Rand is the only reporter who covered the original investigation as well as both trials. With unparalleled access to the Menendez family and their history, including interviews with both brothers before and after their arrest, Rand has uncovered extraordinary details that certainly would have changed the fate of the brothers' first-degree murder conviction and sentencing to life without parole. Rand shares these intimate, never-before-revealed findings, including a deeply disturbing history of child abuse and sexual molestation in the Menendez family going back generations, and the shocking admission O.J. Simpson made to one of the Menendez brothers when they were inmates at the L.A. County Men's Central Jail. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Menendez Murders, the shocking untold story of the Menendez family and the killings that stunned the nation, with my special guest journalist and author, Robert Rand. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Robert Rand.
Hello, Dan. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible, incredible book, and finally we get to talk about this incredible case, one of the most shocking cases in true crime history.
It's a very complex story with many different levels, and it took me 30 years to really compile this entire story.
Yes, incredible. Tell us where you were working professionally at the time this occurred, August 20th, 1989.
In August of 1989, I was a freelance journalist writing 6,000-word feature stories for the Sunday magazine of the Miami Herald. And a few weeks before the night of the Menendez murders, I was in Las Vegas at a trade show for the home video business called the Video Software Dealers Convention. And I was researching just a general story about the home video business, which was an enormous business in the 1980s. And the morning after Jose and Kitty died, I received a phone call in the newsroom at the Miami Herald from a friend of mine, Steve Apple, who was the editor of a trade magazine for the video business. And he told me that a high-profile home video executive, Jose Menendez, and his wife had been blown away the previous evening in Beverly Hills. And I knew that I quickly found out that Jose Menendez was Cuban-American, and so that made it a potential interest to people in Miami. And the initial media coverage of the Menendez murders was really only on the national media radar for 2 or 3 days after the murders.
Right.
And then it just there was some local LA coverage because there were 7 months between the night of the murders and March 8th, 1990, when Lyle Menendez was arrested in Beverly Hills.
Right. Now, what did you do to start these articles? I mean, obviously, these articles progressed to where we are today, as you said, almost 30 years later. Tell us how you started. What was the beginning of those articles and your research therein?
Sure. Well, after I got this phone call from my friend tipping me off, that Jose Menendez, a high-profile home video executive, had been killed, I did a little research and found out that he had a sister who lived in West Palm Beach, about an hour and a half north of Miami. And this is 1989, before the internet, no cell phones. I got out the West Palm Beach phone book and I looked up the sister of Jose Menendez and called her up. And my call was 5% to make a condolence call and 95% to possibly hit on her for a story. And after I introduced myself, Marta Cano, the aunt of Eric and Lyle Menendez, immediately invited me to come up to West Palm Beach and meet her. And we spent 4 hours that afternoon discussing the Menendez family history, which was a fascinating story. The family originally was from Spain. They had been very poor, became wealthy, lost everything, immigrated to Cuba. Had no money, became successful, wealthy all over again. And then Castro came into power and they had to leave Cuba. And the family restarted for a third time in the States. Jose Menendez arrived in the U.S. at the age of 16. He had nothing. He had been leading a country club lifestyle, upper middle class, very comfortable lifestyle in Cuba. And suddenly he was living with distant relatives in an attic in Northeast Pennsylvania. And once again in the States, the family became successful all over again. So I went back to my editor at the Tropic Magazine, Sunday Magazine of the Herald, and said, look, we don't know much about this murder investigation, and the police were being very tight-lipped. I said, but this family has a very interesting story. And so I think we should do a biography of Jose Menendez. Rags to riches Cuban-American story ends in a terrible tragedy. And my editor liked that idea, and I began my initial reporting on the case.
How athletic was Jose, and how much of a factor was that in this story?
Well, Jose Menendez was a star athlete who was actually a swimmer in high school in Pennsylvania, and he was also a tennis player, and so he was, very athletic himself, and when his sons were born, he wanted his sons to become star athletes. And so he spent a lot of time with them. Initially he was interested in them becoming competitive swimmers. And then he switched his focus and the focus of the brothers to tennis. And both brothers became nationally ranked tennis players. Jose Menendez used to wake them up at 4 a.m. and have them hit balls for 3 hours before they would go to school when they were little kids.
Tell us about Mary Louise, they called her Kitty, and how they met and their relationship.
Well, Kitty Menendez was born in a suburb of Chicago, and she went to college at Southern Illinois University. And Jose and Kitty Menendez shared several classes. One of their favorite classes was a debate class where they used to debate each other, and they began a romantic relationship. And they wanted to get married, but Jose was under 18. And in Illinois, you had to be 18 to get married, or you had to have the permission of your parents. And so Jose and Kitty Menendez eloped and went to Indiana and didn't tell their family until after they were married. His father was somewhat upset. His father, whose nickname was Pepin, his real name was also Jose. But Jose Menendez's father told him, "You're too young to get married, and you know, you shouldn't do this." But Jose had made up his mind, decided he wanted to do it, and the young couple did get married. And then the family was happy after they kept the secret for a few months, but the family was happy after everything came out.
Now tell us how they eventually get to, again, where he's this executive at Coracle Pictures, producer of the Rambo and Terminator movies. Tell us how they get finally to where they are in Beverly Hills. What's the route?
It's an interesting story because after Jose and Kitty Menendez were married, they moved to New York City, where Jose was continuing school at Queens College. And Jose and Kitty were broke. They really were just barely getting by. Kitty was doing some work as a substitute teacher. Jose was actually, when he was in college, he was selling encyclopedias door to door. There was one anecdote I heard from the family in which he sold an encyclopedia to a woman, an elderly woman, who after the evening after he sold it to her, he felt guilty. He didn't think she could really afford it. And he went back the next day and, you know, took the encyclopedia back and refunded the woman her money. He was also working as a dishwasher at the 21 Club in New York. Mm-hmm. And so they were really struggling financially. Jose graduated from Queens College and was able to land a job with Cooper's Librand, one of the big eight accounting firms. And from there, he went through a couple other jobs as an executive with different companies. And then one of the biggest jobs in his career was when he became head of U.S. operations for Hertz Rent-A-Car. And after a couple of years of success at Hertz, RCA, the corporate owner, moved Jose to one of the top executives with RCA Records. And so Jose was hoping to become the top executive, the CEO of RCA Records. And when that didn't happen, he pulled the cord on a golden parachute, walked away with $1 million, and began looking for some type of new work in the entertainment business. And one of the offers that came his way was to run the home video division of Caracol Pictures. Caracol Pictures was one of the hottest independent studios in the 1980s. They released the Rambo movies starring Sylvester Stallone. They released the famous Sharon Stone movie, Basic Instinct. And in the 1980s, home video divisions had become a goldmine for the studios. It was a new business. It was really kind of found money. And that's the way people were consuming movies long before streaming. People had, VCRs beta machines in their homes and played movies. And so Jose and Kitty Menendez had lived in Princeton, New Jersey for 20 years with their sons, Eric and Lyle, and they picked up the family and moved out to California. At one point, Jose Menendez talked with his wife, Kitty, and suggested that he and Eric come out to California and that Kitty and Lyle stay in Princeton. Lyle was about to start school at Princeton University, and Kitty Menendez was very involved in charitable groups and community activities, but she quickly turned that down, so the entire family moved to Los Angeles. And initially, for a year and a half, they lived in the L.A. suburb of Calabasas, which nobody had heard of in 1989 national and international level. But, of course, we've since known Calabasas as the home of the Kardashians.
Right. Now, you talk about Mary Louise, and she was involved in some volunteer work, but she was not really pleased with the move from Princeton. She was pretty happy with her friends and her life there, wasn't she?
That's correct. Kitty Menendez had lived in that community for 20 years. She had a lot of friends. She was involved in different activities. Jose Menendez had a sister, Terry Baralt, and her husband, Carlos Baralt, and they had the Baralts had four daughters, and they lived down the street from the Menendezes. The two families were very close. And so for Kitty Menendez, the idea of uprooting her life and moving to California after 20 years in Princeton was really something she did not really want to do that. But at a certain point, after some friction between Jose and Kitty, she did agree to move to Los Angeles. As I said, the family lived in Calabasas for about a year and a half. And then Eric Menendez was involved in a fight at Calabasas High School. Eric was a star player on the Calabasas High tennis team. And one day, some members of the tennis team became involved in a fight with some gang members. And there were some threats being made against the Menendez family. And so that was one of the reasons that Jose and Kitty decided to move to Beverly Hills. And they purchased a mansion on North Elm Drive in the fall of 1988 and made that move to Beverly Hills.
Now, how old was Eric at that time, and where was he in terms of his schooling, and where was Lyle? And there's 4 years, almost 4 years difference in age, but tell us where they were age-wise and education-wise at that point, what they were doing.
Sure. Well, in the fall of 1988, Eric Menendez would have been 17 years old, he had been going to Calabasas High School, and Lyle had just started his first year at Princeton, and I mentioned the gang fight that Eric was involved in as being one mm-hmm. problem that was going on, within the family. But there was another incident that took place in which Eric was involved in some burglaries in Calabasas,
right.
Which he committed with a close friend. And they were, and actually, Eric Menendez, the first burglary he was involved in, the house where they committed the burglary was the home of the parents of a friend of Eric's and another friend of his who was involved in the burglary, Craig Signorelli. And the parents were out of town. They were in Europe on vacation. And Eric's friend, whose parents were out of town, actually gave Eric and Craig the combination to his parents' safe. And they took quite a bit of property out of the house, including property worth about $100,000. And they decided to do a second burglary. And Lyle Menendez was very upset when he heard about this, and he didn't want he was also concerned about the relationship between Eric Menendez and his best friend Craig Signorelli. So Lyle actually was involved in a second burglary with Eric, and again, this was the house of the parents of a friend of Eric Menendez, and overall, over $100,000 worth of property was taken in these burglaries, and eventually the L.A. County Sheriff's Office became involved, and because there had been some talk among the kids at Calabasas High, Eric Menendez was accused of taking part in these burglaries, but they were able to shield Lyle because he was over 18, and so Eric basically took the fall for both of them and was charged as a juvenile. And most of the property was returned, and Jose Menendez wrote a check to cover the rest of the missing property. And that was another reason why the family moved from Calabasas to Beverly Hills, because this was very embarrassing for Jose and Kitty Menendez. And Jose Menendez actually had some thoughts in his head that he might run for political office in the future. His sister told me that he wanted to retire from the entertainment business in 5 or 6 years and run for the U.S. Senate in Florida. So Jose, you know, hired a high profile lawyer, Gerald Chaliff, and the burglary was the burglary case was took place in juvenile court. And as part of the resolution of the burglary case, Eric Menendez was ordered to be evaluated by a therapist. And Kitty Menendez's therapist recommended a doctor by the name of Jerome Ozeal to do that evaluation with Eric. And so Dr. Ozeal, who later plays a major role in the Menendez murder case, that was his initial contact with the Menendez family to prepare this evaluation for juvenile court. And Dr. Ozeal saw Eric Menendez alone in sessions, but Jose and Kitty Menendez had Dr. Ozeal, had Eric Menendez sign a release so that Dr. Ozeal could tell them everything that went on in the therapy sessions. And there were also some group sessions with the entire Menendez family. But this burglary incident, along with this gang fight that I mentioned, both contributed, motivated the family, motivated Jose Menendez to decide to move the family from Calabasas to Beverly Hills. And so they actually made the move to Beverly Hills around Thanksgiving 1988, about 8 months before August 20th, 1989, the night of the murders.
What did Jose say to his boys in his obvious disappointment with them regarding his will?
Well, in the spring of 1989, several months before the murders, Jose Menendez spoke with Carlos Baralt, his brother-in-law, who was the executor of his estate, and he told Baralt that he wanted to remove Eric and Lyle from his will. He was frustrated with them. He was disappointed about the situation with the Calabasas burglaries, and he just wanted to make a change in his estate planning. Jose also had discussions with his sister, Marta Cano, the aunt in West Palm Beach, Florida, and he wanted to, told her that he was going to be drawing up a new will. But Jose was a very busy entertainment executive, and he never got around to following through on those plans to create a new will. And so that this was obviously an important issue and important information during this testimony during the brothers' trials.
Let's talk about August 20th, 1989, and you take us there in 1989, a Sunday night. But before we get that, there's a phone call to someone named Perry Berman. Again, maybe getting ahead of myself here.
Right.
Tell us who Perry Berman is, and then tell us about the Sunday night, or pardon me, the Sunday in the day. What happens at the home, the Menendez home, and then tell us about Perry Berman.
Sure. On Sunday, August 20th, 1989, it was a beautiful, warm August afternoon. The Menendez family was spent the day around the house. They lived in an 8,000-square-foot mansion on North Elm Drive, just below Sunset Boulevard, in a very upscale section of Beverly Hills. And the Menendez mansion had an Olympic-sized swimming pool behind the house, and there was also a tennis court, since both brothers were nationally ranked tennis players and practicing frequently.
Right.
So most of the day, the family was around the house in the pool. The brothers were playing tennis. And at one point, Lyle Menendez had a phone call with Perry Berman, a former tennis coach of the brothers and a friend of both brothers. And they talked about meeting up at a food tasting festival in Santa Monica, about 20 minutes west of Beverly Hills, near the beach. And So they made tentative plans to meet at this food festival. Brothers said they wanted to order Chinese food, but Kitty Menendez was cooking fish. She made dinner, and then the brothers left the house and went to see the movie Batman at a nearby movie theater. And that was basically the original narrative of what the brothers said took place. Perry Berman was at the food festival waiting to meet Eric and Lyle, and they never showed up. And about 11:30 at night, Lyle Menendez called Perry Berman and said, where are you? You know, we're here in Santa Monica at the food festival. And Berman said, it ended about 10 o'clock. He said, I'm just going to bed. Can we talk tomorrow? And Lyle was kind of frantic, and he said, no, I need to talk to you right now. He said, I'm really concerned about if I should go back to Princeton, and concerned about some issues with his father. And he really pushed and pleaded with Berman to meet the brothers right away. And initially, Lyle asked Berman to come meet the brothers at the Menendez mansion. And then Berman said, no, I'm not going to do that. He said, I'll meet you at the Cheesecake Factory restaurant. And so Berman went over to the Cheesecake Factory, and the restaurant was just closing. The chairs were being put up on the table. And again, this is 1989, so we have no cell phones. And so this restaurant was only about 10 minutes away from the Menendez mansion. So Berman decided to drive over to North Elm Drive. And as he pulled up the street, he became very alarmed when he saw that the street was filled with police cars with flashing lights. And what happened was that Eric Menendez, in the initial story that Eric and Lyle Menendez told the police, they said they had come home and walked in and were shocked to find the bodies of their parents.
You talk about that the reason they had mentioned to Perry Berman is that they were going to drop by the house to pick up some Eric's ID, fake ID, so that he could drink. And that was the reason they were just going to stop, park the car outside the house, outside the gate, and then go into that house. And then they found this horror scene. You talk about the 911 call and then their reaction when the police do get there. Tell us a little bit about that, but also what the police failed to do in terms of normal procedure testing in a case like this.
Well, Eric and Lyle Menendez told the police that they, came back from being out of it at the food festival and walked into the house and were, horrified and shocked and emotional when they found the dead bodies of their parents. And Lyle Menendez made a call to 911 at 11:47 p.m. the night of August 20th. And he was emotional and could barely be understood as he told the 911 operator, somebody killed my parents. And in the background of that dramatic 911 call, you can hear Eric Menendez screaming, extremely emotional. And at one point, Lyle Menendez, turns away from the phone and is yelling at Eric, get away from them. And Beverly Hills is a community which is not used to having too many murder cases. In 1989, Beverly Hills averaged two murders a year. And it's a small community. The police responded within a few minutes. And as they pulled up, they were very cautious, as they would be in any crime scene. And the brothers were still in the house, and the police called the house and asked the brothers to come outside. And the brothers, within 30 seconds, came running out the front door. The police went in and began, you know, searching the house, discovered the bodies. And the brothers were extremely emotional, extremely distraught. Eric Menendez was down on the grass in front of the house, pounding the ground, you know, saying, "Who did this? You know, I'm going to kill them." You know, and just extremely overwhelmed. Lyle Menendez was a little calmer, but clearly upset. And the brothers called. The first person the brothers called was their tennis coach, Mark Heffernan, who lived in Santa Monica. He came over to the house. And then the officers told the brothers that they were going to take them to the police station to be interviewed by Sergeant Tom Edmonds. And one of the things that happened that night was, because of the police felt the brothers' emotion was genuine, they were so distraught, the police did not perform gunshot residue tests on Eric and Lyle Menendez.
Right.
If the police had performed that test, kind of a basic procedure, police 101, if the police had performed that GSR test, the Menendez brothers would have been arrested that night. But because the brothers were so distraught, the police didn't do it. The police believed that they were grieving sons. They were both interviewed at the police station. And then at one point, at about 5:30 in the morning, the brothers returned to the house in a taxi, and they had gone out to the home of their tennis coach, Mark Heffernan. At about 5:30 in the morning, the brothers returned to the house, and they met Les Zoeller, the lead investigator for the Beverly Hills Police, and they told Zoeller that they needed to get inside the house because there was some tennis equipment they wanted to pick up, and they needed to get inside the house, and they also wanted to go inside. Eric Menendez's car was parked on the street right outside, right in front of the house. And so Zoeller told them, you know, they couldn't go in the house because it was an active crime scene. He asked them to come back in a few hours. The brothers returned about 8:30 in the morning and briefly went inside the house. But the primary reason they returned was they went into Eric's car and filled an athletic bag with shotgun shells and receipts from the purchase of two shotguns in San Diego several days earlier. And incredibly, in another mistake that the Beverly Hills Police made, they never searched that car, even though it was sitting right outside of the house. If the police had searched that car, they would have found shotgun shells and receipts for two shotguns. And once again, that's it's likely that the brothers might have been arrested that night because of that.
Absolutely. You write that what police did find in that home was that somebody had burst into the Menendez family room and began firing 12-gauge Mossberg shotguns. And somebody had put to the barrel of to Jose's head and pulled the trigger. And Kitty had been found on the ground. And I guess what they determined was a gun was put near her mouth or near her head. And you write that every bone was broken in her face. And so they emptied their weapons. But the police at that time, like you mentioned, that they could have had some incredible incriminating evidence. There was a definite lack of evidence otherwise at that crime scene, wasn't there?
That's correct. This was a horrific crime scene. I've seen the crime scene video and some of the crime scene photographs, which were played and displayed at the brothers' trials. And it was one of the most terrible crime scenes that the detectives had ever encountered. Shotguns are, you know, make unbelievably large wounds. You know, there was blood. There was brain matter dripping from the ceiling when the police came in. The parents were literally blown away. As you mentioned, one of the shotgun blasts was a point blank shot to the back of Jose Menendez's head, and the police were, you know, were really had a tough time themselves processing this very bloody crime scene.
Now, how do police proceed with their investigation? Obviously, they have to go to the family. What did they find out from the family? And just for the sake of our audience, what does the family believe, and are they supportive of the brothers after these murders of their family?
Well, the family, of course, was shocked. The brothers didn't call the family until about 10 or 11 the next morning. Family members are in shock. They all flew to California. All of the initial media speculation was that the murders were somehow related to the home video business. Jose Menendez had recently, his company Live Entertainment, the home video division of Caracol, had recently taken over a company that had been had some connections to the mob. The origins of the home video business were actually in the adult film industry. And so there were many companies that, even though they might release, mainstream studio movies, they also were releasing softcore porn or hardcore porn. And so the initial media speculation was about that it was something related to Jose's business. And 5 days after the murders, the Wall Street Journal ran a headline, "Hints of a Mob Rubout." The L.A. Times ran a story in which they had a source in the L.A. County Sheriff's Office that said, "These murders stink of organized crime." And so that's what the family believed. The brothers were not suspects publicly. And the speculation about the media was fixated on, you know, that it was some sort of mob hit for several months. But in reality, what happened was about 10 days after the murders, an attorney representing the mother of a young girl that the brothers went to school with in Calabasas called the Beverly Hills Police and suggested that the police should take a look at Eric and Lyle Menendez.
Exactly. You write about what Eric and Lyle, in their questioning from police, had said about a potential motive, and also about the character, the characterization of their father as beyond a tough guy to negotiate with, and some of his business practices were considered harsh. What exactly did they tell police, which lent some credibility to the idea that this would have been someone that was targeting the father?
Well, Lyle Menendez spoke to the police about that his father, the quote he used was his father had some shady people that he was working with and in contact with in his business. And so Lyle Menendez actually made the suggestion that these killings could be related to his father's business. He mentioned to the police that the family was getting phone calls at all hours of the day and night, that sometimes shady people would show up at the house. So Lyle was clearly trying to, give that impression to the police that that was the direction they should look at. Eric Menendez was really emotionally distraught and could really, barely complete sentences in the initial interview, the night of the murders. And then the police were over in New Jersey and to interview Jose's sister, Terry Baralt, and her husband, Carlos. And just by accident, this is about 3 weeks after the murders, just by accident, Eric and Lyle Menendez walked into the house while they're interviewing the Baralts. And so the police did a second interview with the Menendez brothers in New Jersey, in which, was obviously a calmer setting 3 weeks after the deaths of Jose and Kitty. And again, the you know, the brothers said they really had no idea, why these murders took place. Eric did mention, that he had been involved in this gang fight. And during that second interview in New Jersey, Eric mentioned that he had a therapist named Dr. Jerome Ozeal, and that police should talk to him. And the police said, well, we'd like to talk to Dr. Ozeal, but we would need you to give us a waiver, because normally there's a privilege between a therapist and a patient. And Eric Menendez never ended up doing that.
You talk about the what Lyle does, I believe, in terms of contacts a computer maintenance business. After he learns that his relative, Carlos Baralt, was going to search a computer looking for files related to the will, because he was privy to what his idea of changing that will. When, I believe, Lyle finds out about this, tell us what he does in terms of hiring this company.
Sure. Several days after the deaths of Jose and Kitty, the family was out in California, and they were frantically looking all over the house trying to find a copy of Jose and Kitty's will. I mentioned earlier that Carlos Baralt had a conversation with Jose in the spring of '89, a few months before the murders, about removing the brothers from the will. And so, but nobody knew if, you know, a new will had actually been created. And at one point, the Jose and Kitty had one of the old original Apple computers in their bedroom. It was an IBM computer. They took a look at the computer themselves and couldn't figure out, how to get into the files. And so they made arrangements for somebody to come and try to look at the computer. Lyle Menendez was aware of this, and before the Baralt's computer expert came over, Lyle Menendez opened the Yellow Pages, called a company, and had a man called the local LA company, and had a man come over. He told that man that he was going to sell the computer and he wanted to erase the hard drive. And the brothers were particularly interested. There were four files titled Eric, Lyle, Will, and Menendez. And the brothers were extremely interested in those four files, but it turned out there were only about 50 or 100 characters in each of those files. So there was no new will on the computer. And even if there had been a will or a draft of a will on the computer, I'm not sure that would have been a legal document, since it would have just been a file on a computer and not a signed, notarized document. So Lyle told the computer expert that he hired, that he was selling the computer to please erase everything off the hard drive. So a couple days later, another computer expert shows up at the house, the man who had been hired by the family, and he goes to take a look at the computer, and the entire hard drive is erased. And so later that obviously became a significant piece of evidence for the prosecution.
Also, you talk about right after this, in terms of suspicious behavior, that they had gotten a $250,000 insurance policy claim given to them almost immediately. What was the will estimated at that was originally, from anything that anybody knew, all going to go to these brothers?
Right. Well, just to finish the thought on what happened with the will, at one point, nothing is on the computer when the Carlos Baralt, the executor of the estate, has a computer expert at the house, and he finds that the hard drive is wiped clean. The family continued searching in the house, and at one point They found a signed will in a drawer in the parents' bedroom, and it was that will was created in 1980, and it left everything to the brothers. The family really had no suspicion and no thought that the brothers could have been involved in any way in their parents' murder. And the family in the media kept repeating that the family estate was worth $14 million. The reality is that the family estate was worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 to $8 million. That's still a lot of money. But they had a house in Calabasas that they were doing a reconstruction on, and they also owned a house in Beverly Hills. So really, Jose Menendez was kind of heavily leveraged. And so 5 weeks after the murders, the brothers got together with their aunt, who was back in California from Florida, and she told them that they were the beneficiaries of a life insurance policy, which the brothers did not know anything about until that day, 5 weeks after the murders. And so 5 weeks after the murders, each brother received a check for $250,000 in cash. And the brothers actually never got their hands on any of the money from the Menendez estate. There was a loan made from the estate to Lyle when he purchased a chicken wing restaurant in Princeton, but the brothers each get $250,000 in their bank accounts, and they began to go out spending a lot of money. Lyle bought a new Porsche, Eric bought a Jeep, Lyle bought a Rolex for himself and a Rolex for Eric, and they were traveling all over the country on MGM Air, which was a upscale small airline back then. And one of the things that people don't always know about the Menendez family is because the brothers were nationally ranked tennis players, Jose Menendez had given each brother an American Express card, and he allowed them to charge up to $10,000 a month. So this was an upper-class family. They were used to spending a lot of money. The brothers were used to spending a lot of money. So the fact that they continued spending money after their parents' deaths was actually not something that seemed unusual to the family members. The media after the brothers were arrested was entirely focused on Eric and Lyle Menendez went on this crazy spending spree after they killed their parents, and the reality was that they had spent a lot of money before their parents died. And one of the things that you know I like to bring up to people is if you were 18 years old and somebody handed you $250,000 in cash, to me the surprise would be if you didn't go out and buy a new car and buy some fancy clothes and buy a watch. So the spending spree evidence was never that critical to me in my evaluation of the case. And one of the most interesting factoids about the case is that in August of 92, 1 year before the brothers went on trial, prosecutors presented evidence to an L.A. County grand jury, evidence of murder for financial gain, The grand jury did not indict the Menendez brothers on those charges of murder for financial gain. But in spite of the fact that the grand jury did not return that indictment, the prosecution grabbed onto that as their theme because the general public hates the rich the prosecution decided, and the media had picked up on that theme. One of the interesting elements of the whole Menendez story is how the media, back in the early 1990s, the media had such an impact on high-profile trials. Again, this is years before the internet, many years before social media, and so back then, when the mainstream media set an agenda in your case, that was basically it. You could stick a fork in it. You were done. You were cooked. And that's what happened with Eric and Lyle Menendez. They became the greedy rich kids from the first week they were arrested, and the media stuck with that.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Robert, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, FabFitFun. The FabFitFun Fall Box is on sale now. They do the shopping for you. Each box can be customized to your very specific interests, and the Fall Box is a fantastic way to spoil yourself and others with the coolest curated box of unique products. These boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. My wife Lisa was very excited to get her very first FabFitFun box. She was thrilled with all the great products she received. In the Fall Box she just received, she especially liked the gourmet wood and ceramic cheese board gift set by Twine and a really nice 2-in-1 salt and pepper grinder from Epair and daily hair repair from Avita. Lisa is always anxious to get her next FabFitFun box. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Robert, we have to talk about how the eventually, soon, or not so soon, the two are arrested and why, and then take us to the trial because we, as we talked about in the introduction, there's two trials and there's so much and it's such a complicated case. Let's get to how they were arrested before we start talking about the first trial.
Sure. So after the brothers received this insurance payout, they were spending a lot of money. The Beverly Hills Police actually had received this tip about 10 days after the murders that they should take a close look at the brothers. And I had just spent 2 months of reporting about the home video business in my working on a story for the Miami Herald. And so I reached out to all of those contacts that I was in touch with. And the basic consensus was that these killings had nothing to do with the home video business. And even though the media continued that speculation, I basically hit a dead end. And the reality was that the police were focused on the brothers. And I came out to California 2 months after the murders, 5 months before the brothers were arrested, in my reporting for that biography about Jose Menendez. And I spent a couple days with Eric and Lyle. And they were not suspects publicly. I had no reason to be suspicious of them. And we did... Over the course of 2 days, the brothers told me loving stories of how close-knit the family was. They told me how much they missed the parents. They were emotionally appropriate. And as I said, I had no reason to be suspicious of them. The 2 days I spent with the brothers were the end of October 1989. And... the second day, I was actually with Eric Menendez alone. Lyle Menendez did not want me to use a tape recorder. I did audio tape the interview with Eric. And after we finished the interview, Eric actually invited me to come out and see the family's dream house in Calabasas. So he volunteered to spend more time with me. 9 days after I did that interview with Eric Menendez, he contacted his therapist, Dr. Jerome O'Zeal, and said that he needed to come see him. And on that day, Halloween 1989, Eric Menendez confessed to Dr. O'Zeal that he and Lyle were responsible for their parents' deaths. Dr. O'Zeal was shocked. He had Eric call Lyle, who was passing out Halloween candy with his girlfriend at the Menendez mansion. And Lyle Menendez rushed over to Dr. O'Zeal's office in Beverly Hills and was extremely upset with Eric, was obviously concerned that Dr. O'Zeal was going to go to the Beverly Hills Police. And there was a very emotional, dramatic session with Dr. Ozeal and the two brothers. And at the end of that session, Dr. Ozeal walked the brothers to the elevator, and Lyle Menendez shook the therapist's hand and said, good luck, Dr. Ozeal, as in he was going to need some good luck. And Dr. Ozeal interpreted that moment as that Lyle Menendez was threatening to him. Normally, you have a privilege with a therapist. The therapist cannot reveal what goes on in a therapy session. There's an exception to that privilege under California law called the Tarasoff rule. If you threaten your therapist, or if you threaten, you know, if you tell a therapist, I'm going to go kill my girlfriend tomorrow, then he is allowed under California law to break the privilege and tell, you know, people around him, his family, you know, that there's a potential danger, and also to possibly go to the police. But Dr. Ozeal did not go to the police, but he had a girlfriend by the name of Judalon Smith. Dr. Ozeal was married with two young daughters. He had a girlfriend named Judalon Smith. And there's a little confusion over what exactly happened the night that Eric Menendez confessed to Dr. Ozeal. Judalon Smith originally told police and in some media interviews that she had been in the waiting room of Dr. Ozeal's office on the night the brothers confessed, and that she had overheard the confession as she was sitting down the hall. I don't believe that ever happened. Dr. Ozeal let me into the office and let me see that the waiting room was quite a bit, quite a long distance from the therapy room. And when the door to the therapy room was closed and the door to the waiting room was closed, there's no way that she would have heard anything. I believe what happened is that Dr. Ozeal gossiped with his girlfriend. And sure. Then that created a whole new set of problems, because Dr. Ozeal was interested in kind of maintaining control over the Menendez brothers. He talked to them about possibly becoming their financial advisor. And at one point, they started having therapy sessions after the night of the confession. And Dr. Ozeal, at one point, a few weeks in, said, look, I'm going to schedule two therapy sessions a day, one for each of you, 5 days a week. And he said, told them, I don't care if you ever show up. And the brothers, you know, really obviously interpreted that into that he was blackmailing them. And that was an accusation that the defense made during the first trial. The family members kept getting these large bills from Dr. Ozeal. Their aunt, Marchicano, received one bill for $10,000 and called Eric and said, what's going on? And Eric said, oh, Aunt Marta, this is really important, the therapy, so please just keep paying these bills. And in the background of all of this, the relationship between Dr. Ozeal and Judalon Smith was beginning to go sour. And he had, as I mentioned, he had already revealed that the brothers had confessed to him. And so Smith started making threats, saying that she was going to go to the Beverly Hills police and tell them the brothers had confessed. And at one point, Dr. Ozeal recorded a hour-long therapy session. You can put quotes around that. And they had these tapes in a safe deposit box and as a way to ensure his safety. So Judalon Smith was aware that there was a tape of the brothers and also audio notes from some of these therapy sessions. And so in a curious twist of the Ozeal Smith story, Dr. Ozeal and his wife moved Smith into their house with their daughters in an effort to keep the lid on her, to keep her from going to the police. And at some point, several months later, that whole situation blows up. Dr. Ozeal and his wife, who is also a therapist, come home one night. All the furniture in their house has been rearranged. And Dr. Ozeal walks down the hallway and he hears Smith talking to his 8-year-old daughter and telling her, I'm going to be your new mommy and your mommy's going to be leaving. The Ozeals kick Smith out of the house. And the next day she goes to the Beverly Hills police. And a day later, the Beverly Hills police show up at Dr. Ozeal's house with a search warrant. They seize the audio tapes from his safe deposit box. And a few hours later, Lyle Menendez is arrested.
Now, right away in this, as as we've just spoken, these tapes are crucial in terms of recorded evidence, incriminating, damning evidence. But there's the idea of admissibility and this idea of patient-doctor confidentiality. When they get to trial and they're fighting about this, because this is the first fight, a serious fight that's going to have consequences for both prosecution and defense, what happens in terms of that admissibility and those tapes?
The Menendez case did not go to trial for 3 years, as both sides, the prosecution and the defense, fought a very bitter battle over the admission of those tapes. As I mentioned, normally under California law, you know, there's a privilege with a therapist, and I also mentioned the exception to that privilege if you threaten your therapist, as Dr. Ozeal claimed had taken place. I don't believe that Lyle Menendez did threaten him. I believe he was simply trying to save his career. But the issue of the admission of those tapes went all the way to the California Supreme Court. And shortly before the trial, the California Supreme Court ruled that the tapes could be admitted as evidence. The interesting thing about the trial or the case was that the Beverly Hills police did not really have a strong case without those tapes. But once the tapes were admitted as evidence, the defense had to completely shift, and the case went from being if those tapes had not been admitted, even it would have been like the Emperor's New Clothes. Everybody knew there were tapes. And what was on those tapes. But if the tapes had not been admitted as evidence into court, the defense would have been, whodunit? You know, you say Eric and Lyle Menendez killed their parents. Let's see your evidence. And the prosecution did not have a strong case. But the tapes were admitted, and so the defense shifted. And about 2 weeks before the trial, Leslie Abramson, the lead defense attorney with the blonde curly hair, did an interview with the LA Times, in which she revealed that the defense was the brothers were going to tell a story of a lifetime of abuse and molestation and a series of confrontations in the days before the murders that led up to the actual killing of Jose and Kitty Menendez. And the general public was a little confused. Most of the public believed, because of the media coverage, that Eric and Lyle Menendez's defense was, we were abused, we were molested, and so therefore we get a pass, or that's why we killed our parents. The actual legal defense was, we were in fear for our lives. There were these series of...
And that's what you would call the involuntary manslaughter, where it's they have a fear of imminent danger, however, even though that's unreasonable in someone else's mind. Robert has just left us in mid-question, and I was just talking to him about the distinction in the first trial in terms of admissibility of two of the tapes, or four tapes, and two of those tapes were deemed admissible because they did speak to the alleged threats that were made by the psychiatrist, by Ozeal. The distinction in court was that a jury would be able to hear that information. And here we are with Robert again to explain.
We got cut off.
You were talking about we were talking about that admissibility and that distinction. And tell us more about that distinction and what was contained in those tapes. And that the prosecution had to readjust their strategy.
Well, let me just give you a quick background of how that tape was created. So Eric Menendez confessed to Dr. Ozeal on October 31st, 1989. And about 6 weeks later, Dr. Ozeal suggested that the brothers record an audio tape with him so that in the event that they were arrested at some point, that they would be able to show that they had remorse for the killing of their parents. And Gerald Chaliff, who was one of the criminal defense attorneys involved in the case early on, and he was Lyle's original defense attorney when he was arrested. Gerald Chaliff actually had a meeting with Dr. Rozelle in his office for about an hour before they brought the brothers in. And then Chaliff left the room, and Rozelle recorded this hour-long so-called therapy session with the brothers. And in this 60-minute tape, which was obviously a key piece of evidence in the trials, the brothers are heard saying that they, were thinking about whether to actually commit the murders for several days, and talked in. It's just kind of a strange tape. Dr. Rozelle is doing most of the talking. He's really kind of leading the brothers. There's some harsh moments. There was one moment where Lyle says, I miss my mother, but I also miss my dog, if I can make such a gross analogy. The tape was really pretty damaging for the brothers' defense. But in an interesting twist, there's so many interesting twists in this story. In an interesting twist, after the Supreme Court, ruled that the tape could be admitted as evidence, obviously the prosecution was going to admit or introduce the case, the tape, during their case. And the defense waited until both of the brothers testified, and then the defense actually introduced the tape. And the reason they did that was because they knew it was going to be introduced one way or the other. So by the defense introducing it, then after the tape was played, they immediately put three or four defense therapy experts on the stand to put their spin on this whole tape. And so that really kind of softened the blow of some of the negative things, that the jury was hearing in that 1 hour tape.
What I mentioned with just the short interruption was the imminent danger. So what is exactly their defense in terms of they weren't abused, it wasn't revenge for the abuse. So what was their defense that they presented in court in terms of this imminent danger that they thought they perceived as imminent?
Well, the defense is called an imperfect self-defense. And the abuse and molestation are a factor in they are an element in that type of defense. This defense was really kind of unusual in 1993. You have to remember many years ago. Basically, in the late 1980s. The women were starting to use a battered women's defense in cases where abused women had killed their husband or boyfriend. And so the Menendez defense was kind of unique in that basically they were creating a new kind of a tangent of that defense, and that was they were creating a battered child defense. It was an important element for the defense attorneys to present the entire family history of Jose and Kitty Menendez, including their own childhoods. And Judge Stanley Weisberg, who had also been the judge on the famous Rodney King trial that led to the L.A. riots, Judge Weisberg gave the defense quite a bit of leeway in the first trial and allowed them to present 65 teachers, coaches, family friends, relatives. And so the jury heard quite a bit of evidence about the background of Eric and Lyle Menendez. It's difficult for the public because the public, when you're only seeing a daily newspaper story or you're seeing a minute 30 TV story on the 11 o'clock news, it's really difficult to get into these complex issues. But the fact that half of the Menendez jurors voted for manslaughter in the first trial and half of the jurors voted for murder tells you that that evidence of the family history had a significant impact in the decision-making
Sure.
of the jury. And there were two juries, one for each brother, in the first trial.
What happens in the first trial, despite that family background being exposed and despite the performances of the brothers at the trial as well? They were decent performances, if we can judge it by that. What happened with the jury? What was the decision?
Well, the juries were split along gender lines for the most part. Basically, almost all the women voted for manslaughter, and almost all the men voted for murder. The deliberations for Lyle Menendez went on for, I think, almost three weeks. Neither jury could reach a decision. And so the trial ended with a mistrial, two hung juries. And I interviewed all the jurors after the first trial. And all of the men told me some variation of a father would never do that to his sons. And I think 26 years later, I think society has evolved in that people are willing to accept the possibility that this type of abuse does take place. But for the women who voted for manslaughter, they were quite, comfortable with their decision based on those 65 defense witnesses that they saw. And the trial was broadcast live, gavel to gavel, on Court TV, a new cable channel in the early 90s. And people that were watching that trial every day like a novella, watched every moment of the trial, I think they had an understanding of, where the truth was in this case.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the first trial, when they finally get to trial after the two mistrials, they finally get to trial, and there's the involuntary manslaughter decision. So, obviously, that's what the jury believed, and that was the decision. What happens after that? Why another trial?
Well, so the first trial ended in a mistrial because neither jury, there was one for each brother, neither jury could decide on a verdict. There was bitter fighting in each jury room, and a mistrial was declared. And within an hour after that mistrial was declared, L.A. District Attorney Gil Garcetti had a news conference and announced immediately that he was going to retry the Menendez brothers, because he said this is a case of first degree murder, and we're not going to settle this case. We're going back to trial again. And if this had not been a high profile media case, there would never have been a second trial. There would have been a plea agreement, and that would have been it. But the L.A. County, there are politics involved in this story. Also, the L.A. County District Attorney's Office was on a terrible losing streak. They had lost a case called the McMartin molestation trial. They had lost the Rodney King trial. And they lost the O.J. trial. So they really needed a win. And the second Menendez trial, unfortunately for the brothers, had the misfortune of their second trial started the day after the O.J. Simpson verdict in October 1995. So the first thing the judge did was he kicked out the TV camera because he knew that would cut down on the media coverage. And then the judge proceeded to basically reverse most of his evidence rulings from the first trial. And the defense had the heart of its case from the first trial cut out. The judge was determined not to allow most of the witnesses the defense had put on at the first trial. The therapy experts and the witnesses that did testify, the judge severely limited their testimony. So in the second trial, there was only one jury, and the jurors heard a completely different set of evidence than the first trial jurors. The second trial was really much more like a traditional murder trial, with forensic people, blood spatter experts. Prosecution brought in a company to do a reconstruction of the crime scene that went on for days and days. And this company that was called Failure Analysis, they had never done a reconstruction of a crime scene before. They had no background in that. The head of the company, Roger McCarthy, was a key prosecution witness in the second trial. Failure Analysis was known for recreating the Space Challenger shuttle disaster and doing a recreation of what happened at the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but they'd never been involved in a murder case before. And so The second trial was very different. It wasn't on TV, much less media coverage. And the defense basically was limited at every in every direction that they tried to go. They weren't allowed to put on the heart of their case that had been the defense in the first trial. And then as the case was coming to a close, Judge Stanley Weisberg put the final nail in the brother's coffin when he ruled that the jury could not consider manslaughter charges for them. And he was not going to allow the defense attorneys to argue for an imperfect self-defense manslaughter verdict. And basically, as the second trial was ending, the jury was restricted to either a second-degree murder or a first-degree murder conviction. In March 1996, the single jury returned a first-degree murder conviction. The jury returned a first-degree murder conviction for Eric and Lyle Menendez. And then that meant that there would be a penalty phase to determine. The jury had two choices based on the judge's instructions, and those choices were the death penalty or life without parole. And then a penalty phase was held for several weeks.
Right. And those things that happened, that information was brought in the first trials, was now in the mitigating stage, in the penalty phase, wasn't it? Some of those
That's
things
correct.
Were brought up.
During the penalty phase, the judge did allow the defense to put on all of those witnesses that had been the heart of their case in the first trial. And it was very emotional testimony, very dramatic testimony, and the jurors voted for life without parole. And after the second trial, after the penalty phase verdict, some of the jurors were involved in a news conference in the courtroom, and several jurors said that they thought life without parole was a harsher sentence than the death penalty. And several months after that, I interviewed many of the jurors, and several of them told me that if they had heard that family history in the guilt phase of the case, they would not have voted for murder. And so there have been accusations made that, that there was some sort of fix going on with the judge and the way everything rolled out. And the brothers went through all their appeals. Their final appeal was at the Ninth Circuit Court in California. And one of the justices, Alex Kaczynski, said during that appeal hearing that he believed there had been collusion between Judge Weisberg and the DA's office, and yet Justice Kaczynski still voted down the appeal.
We talked about in the introduction about some information that came to you that you believe could have a bearing on a possible, because of new evidence, because of a potential new trial for these brothers. Talk about Marta Sano's son, Andy, or it's Lyle's cousin. So tell us about Andy Sano.
Marta.
And this letter that you discover and how you discover this.
Well, Marta Cano was, my original source, my original entry into the Menendez family. And we had been very close, over the 30 years that we've been talking. And Marta Cano is the sister of Jose Menendez. Joan Vandermolen is the sister of Kitty Menendez. And I have been talking since 1989 to Marta, and 1990 I met Joan. And I believe that the Menendez brothers are telling the truth about the abuse and the molestation that took place in the family. And I believe them not just based on their testimony, which is very compelling, and the hundreds of hours of interviews and phone calls we've had over the years, but I have had so much contact with the brothers' two aunts, Marta and Joan, and I have learned so much about what was going on inside this family that this is not a story about two greedy rich kids. The real story of the Menendez murders is a case of involving a family where there was intergenerational sexual abuse and Jose Menendez was molested by his mother, according to his sister, Marta Cano, and Kitty Menendez was molested by an older member of the family, according to her sister, Joan Vandermolen. And so one of the key witnesses for the defense was Marta Cano's son, Andy Cano. And Andy testified in both trials, and he told the story of when he was 10 years old and Eric was 12. And one day they were out playing in a field, and Eric Menendez asked Andy if his father, ever touched his genitals or massaged his genitals. And, Andy was 10 years old. He was kind of surprised, and he said no. And Eric talked about that something was going on with his father, but he made Eric swear with a pinky promise that he would never tell anybody, and he immediately wanted to go tell his mother. And Eric said, no, my father will kill me if you tell anybody. And so that was key testimony in both trials. And then as I was working on my book, I was close to the deadline of my book in March of 2018, and Marta Cano had invited me over to her home in West Palm Beach, and we were going through. She thought that there might have been some letters between Eric and Andy Cano, and so we were going through. And Andy tragically died in 2003. He was very traumatized by this case, and he took an accidental overdose of sleeping pills. And so Marta Cano had boxes of Andy's possessions and papers in her attic, and we pulled some of those boxes down and started going through the boxes. And within an hour, I found a letter that Eric Menendez had written to Andy Cano in December of 1988. And in that letter, Eric Menendez talks about it's clear from the letter that Eric Menendez was having ongoing communication with his cousin Andy about the molestation. And I'll read you one quick paragraph, a couple sentences sure. from the letter in which Eric wrote to his cousin, "I've been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. I can't explain it. He's so overweight that I can't stand to see him. I never know when it's going to happen, and it's driving me crazy. Every night I stay up thinking he might come in. I need to put it out of my mind. I know what you said before, but I'm afraid. You just don't know Dad like I do. He's crazy. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone." So this was quite a – when I read this letter out loud to Marta Cano, she became emotional, and we were both extremely surprised because I knew all the evidence from both trials and over the course of the investigation. And I contacted the lawyers and the brothers and found out that this letter had never been introduced at either of the trials or was never brought up in any evidence hearing. And there is no the letter was just a loose couple pages, in a box with many other papers. There's no envelope with a postmark. But the letter is self-authenticated by references that Eric is making mm-hmm. in it. One of them is he's talking about a Christmas family, that the Christmas party that the family had just held at the mansion with all the employees at Live Entertainment. And I knew about that party. I knew when it took place. And he also talked about in the letter that the family had just hired Mark Heffernan as their new tennis coach, and that took place in November of 1988. And the brothers' appeal attorney is having forensic testing done, and it can be determined by it's a handwritten letter. It can be determined approximately the date that letter was written, and the appeal attorney is confident that it really was written in December of 1988. The murders were August of 89. So in order, the brothers have exhausted all their original appeals. In order to open a new appeal in California, you have to have new evidence. And so that letter is one piece of potential new evidence that could lead to the filing of a new appeal. I hope there will be the filing of a new appeal. And there is some other evidence that I have discovered since my book was published. And so basically, I just want to say stay tuned because this story isn't over yet.
Wow, that's incredible. What we haven't told about our audience, and it's chronicled in your book in incredible detail and is very, very vivid, is the betrayal that the image that the family presented was much, much different. And you say this generational sexual abuse, but this father was an extraordinarily, when we talk about controlling figure, this was an extraordinary controlling behavior in terms of telling the mother and the father, tell them they shouldn't have any friends because that would, they would lose their competitiveness. The humiliation and degradation, regardless of the success that they had in tennis, the monitoring, and right at the end, where Eric was supposed to go to UCLA to go to school, he was also told by his father, no, you're going to stay home 3 or 4 days so we can monitor your work. And these are grown adults that they were doing this. And what lent credibility to what you were saying is that their defense was, their claim was by Abramson, was that they were afraid. That night, they were afraid that they were going to be killed. There was a conversation that was said by their father that indicated to them, they said, that no matter that their choices had been made and they believed their father was a very dangerous person that would put into motion this threat. Wasn't that true?
Yes. A lot of people had a, were confused, about as the details were coming out about the background of the family, because Jose and Kitty Menendez were very controlling of the brothers' lives. One of the things they used to do was they used to do their homework. It didn't take teachers long to figure out that the homework was always perfect, and then the brothers would fail when they took a test in the classroom. The parents used to tell the brothers, you know, who they could date, who they could be friends with. So they controlled every aspect of their sons' lives. So this was a family in which Jose and Kitty were very careful to maintain the facade of the perfect family. You know, on the outside, this family looked perfect. They lived in a mansion in Beverly Hills. Father was an entertainment executive making millions of dollars a year. The mother, former beauty queen, happy housewife. And the sons were internationally ranked tennis players. So on the outside, this family looked perfect, but it was all a facade. The reality was that the Menendez family was spinning out of control. A pair of dysfunctional parents had raised a couple of dysfunctional kids, and everything ended in this terrible tragedy.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the Menendez murders, the shocking, untold story of the Menendez family and the killings that stunned the nation. For people that might want to take a look at this, do you have a Facebook page or a website that they might take a look at more information about this book?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Dan. And I do have a website. I do have a website, MenendezMurders.com, which has background about the case and background about my book. And I also want to mention that in the fall of 2017, NBC produced an 8-hour limited series called Law and Order, True Crime, The Menendez Murders. And I was hired by Dick Wolf, the legendary Law and Order producer, and worked with that series as a consultant. And the series stars Edie Falco, and it is streaming on all major platforms. And if you're interested in the case, it's a very good binge, a series to binge. So please check that out, as well as my website, MenendezMurders.com.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Robert. We could go on and talk about this for hours and hours because it's such an incredible and fascinating case that touched everybody throughout the world. It's fantastic to be able to get you to be able to discuss this just for a short while. I want to thank you very much, Robert Rand, for coming on and talking about the Menendez murders. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
You have a great evening. Good night.
You too.